KBTC, a viewer-supported community service of Bates Technical College.
From KBTC Public Television Studios in Tacoma, Washington, it's the Northwest Now podcast. Each week, we take a closer look at the people and issues that affect all of us here in Western Washington. So sit back, relax, and join the conversation with your host, Tom Lason.
A single gunshot again changes the trajectory of American history. Charlie Kirk gunned down because of his ideas and the purely verbal arguments he made. For years, walking on eggshells was part and parcel of living in a cancel culture. And now, people like Stephen Colbert, Jimmy Kimmel, and institutions like public broadcasting are getting their taste. It has all reinvigorated the discussion about free speech. Many people don't understand what constitutional free speech really is, and that's part of the discussion tonight with UW political science professor James Long and Seattle University School of Law professor Andrew Siegel. Free speech is the topic next on Northwest Now. Free speech means that we have a consequence-free right to say anything we want whenever we want, right? Wrong. Your employer might very well blow you right out the door for what you say or write. Your school might expel you. Even your church might gently explain that you're no longer a good fit. There are perfectly legal consequences that can sometimes come along with speaking your mind. But the free speech as protected in the U.S. Constitution is a bit of a different animal. And that's part of our discussion now with UW political science professor James Long and Seattle U Law School faculty member Andrew Siegel. Thank both of you for coming to Northwest Now to have a really timely discussion, I think, about free speech, what it is, what it isn't, how it's impacting our view of how society is running right now, especially in an era of social media. There's a lot to unpack here. Let's start with a little background, though. James, start with a little bit. Tell us who you are, what your major areas of study are, and what your interest in this topic is.
Sure. I'm a professor of political science at the University of Washington, where I also co-direct the Political Economy Forum. And I'm also a member of their new civic health initiative as well. So I think universities have a particular role to play in fostering free speech, and that's really my interest in it.
Andrew, same question to you. What is your interest in this? And you have a list, and James, you may as well. I don't want to exclude you from this, but your list of publishing, I could fill the 26 minutes we have listing your publications. Talk a little bit about your areas of interest and how you fit into this.
Sure. I've been a professor and first time as an administrator at CLU for about 20 years. I am a professor of constitutional law. I write mostly about constitutional law, about the Supreme Court as an institution, former law clerk to Justice Stevens at the Supreme Court, so got some experience there. I teach about this stuff. I write about this stuff. I interact with the students about it. They have lots of questions, and it's really timely stuff to be talking about.
I think constitutional theory and the impact of that on democracies and how that works, you know, you guys really sit at the intersection perfectly for this discussion. And I want both of your input. So I'm going to ask the same question to both of you. James, start with you. I think people have a major misunderstanding of what free speech is all the time. I see this in social media, people just spraying you know what and say, well, what's the problem? Why are there consequences? We have free speech in this country. Would you please tell the folks who missed civics class and government class in high school what free speech is and what free speech is not?
Well, thank you for mentioning civics in high school. We've had a collapse of civics education, I fear, so I encourage students to take social science classes when they go to college and then also perhaps go to law school. I think free speech is a broad thing, and it has a particular meaning with respect to the First Amendment. So it has a particular legal meaning that I'll let Andrew talk about. But I think there's a broader cultural aspect to it as well, which is that the First Amendment protects citizens from the government, but it doesn't protect citizens from each other. And so I think the culture of free speech is not just about having First Amendment protections, but also that citizens are allowed to freely express themselves without fear of cancellation for speech that otherwise would be protected by the First Amendment.
And that has not proven to be the case, though, has it?
No. History is full of cancellation attempts. What's called Milton's curse refers to the English author John Milton, which is basically free speech for me, but not for thee. People always sort of like the First Amendment when they think it protects them, or they like to say what they want on Twitter. But then if they ever come under the ire of prevailing opinion or opposing opinion, then it's, you know, people become victimized and people also try to censor others or opinions that they don't like.
Andrew, I think, that's a great point about this cultural penumbra that exists around the constitutional, fairly tightly defined definition of free speech under the First Amendment. Talk a little bit about, though, and how do you see the line, and how do you see people misinterpreting it?
No, absolutely. I think that that's exactly right. There is definitely a broader values-driven cultural commitment to freedom of speech, free expression. But the constitutional right is a right against government. And that's, I think, the point that we all want to emphasize. It's a right against all different levels of government, imposing censorship upon people, imposing punishments, providing government benefits only to people of particular viewpoints. To bring an action under the First Amendment requires government action, state action, or government interference in some way. A lot of things the government can do to regulate speech are okay if they're neutral and things like that. But when the government starts imposing viewpoint distinctions, making content-based distinctions, limiting speech altogether in certain areas, then we run into the problems the Constitution is speaking to.
So we get right into the news cycle then, and we look at things like the chairman of the FCC threatening broadcasters with their licenses because of some of their content issues. PBS losing its funding to talk about an issue that hits close to home here at KPTC. So James, you talked a little bit about this previously. Wrap that a little more into context for us. Are those cancel culture things? Are they free speech issues? It seems like there's a lot of check marks, a lot of boxes to check there.
Yeah, I think the cancellation of Jimmy Kimmel is a complicated question because it is, allegedly it is sort of the FCC or government pressuring or a company feeling pressured by the government to make a specific decision. And so I think people were talking about the legality of that when it happened. But even if you were to take the FCC pressure out of it, if you were just to look at the pressure by ABC and some ABC affiliates not to air the show after Jimmy Kimmel made remarks about Charlie Kirk's death, that is sort of social pressure. Or market pressure as well. And so I think companies are constantly finding themselves, promoting certain things and getting criticized for that. And then, they censor something and then they get criticized for that. And so we even saw ABC and the ABC affiliates back off once people then started to boycott their Disney Plus subscription, for example, after the cancellation of Jimmy Kimmel. And so these things have a sort of vicious cycling to them. And I think the role of private actors, comedians, companies is really interesting in this question. But again, it is often separated from what the role of government is.
And constitutionally, the companies were well within their rights to make content choices based on ratings or the reaction of the public or even on ownership opinion to some degree. But as soon as the FCC stepped in and said, something, we can do this the easy way or the hard way, which was the quote. Now, that gets us back into the First Amendment, no?
Yeah, it's an interesting aspect of the era here that they say all the quiet parts out loud. Usually in a case like this, you have to look behind the scenes, speculate, try to figure out if the government is applying some sort of coercive pressure here. But they literally are saying it out loud on the news, tweeting it out, and building a file, building a case for someone like Jimmy Kimmel or others in similar situations to be able to come in and allege government influence, the government being behind the decision. It was about licensing. It was about mergers. It was about access to news and access to government. And the Trump administration has been very clear in a lot of contexts that they're weaponizing those kinds of things.
That seems like a clear violation to me.
There always are questions of proof. They can backtrack. They can say they meant other things. You can provide evidence. You can try to provide counter evidence that the decision wasn't actually motivated by this, but by market concerns, as you said, or something else. But it's a really good start for the lawyers for someone like Kimmel.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about the assassination of Charlie Kirk, and you guys touched upon the cancellation piece of this. There was a major wave of cancellations, in the early 2020s that was, a lot of people would tell you is left canceling right. Now we're a little bit into right canceling left to some degree. And we've seen that with people expressing their views, being unsympathetic to it in that assassination. Are they two sides of the same coin, James? Are they somehow different? And what do people need to understand, about where their free speech rights possibly end when it comes to maybe what their employer thinks? Or their or their church thinks and says, you know something, we're not a great fit anymore, which happened a couple of times apparently too, or their school district. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, this is Milton's curse. So John Milton was an author. He's a famous, in British history, a famous advocate for free speech. But he himself tried to censor Catholic writings or writings about Catholic teaching. And so we call it Milton's curse because you can be pro-free speech for your side one minute and censoring another side, particularly if that side is in the minority or is seen as having some sort of heterodox opinion. And so it's not surprising to me at all that when the left kind of had the cultural cachet and majority opinion in the 2020s, that then shifted when Trump was reelected. And so these things are constantly cycling, and that's why we need a First Amendment, is to say, without fear or favor, this applies to everyone. It doesn't matter what the majority opinion is at any one moment. And this was well understood by the framers, in the sense that one of the things that when Andrew was talking, I was reminded of talking about government putting market pressure on, is the Stamp Act itself was basically a tax that the king put on the colonies to increase the price of the paper that newspapers were sold on, to basically effectively censor those newspapers, right? And so governments, and the framers well understood this, and that's why freedom of the press is put in the First Amendment. But then the framers themselves even became the biggest hypocrites and violators of this, if we think of John Adams and the Alien and Sedition Acts. And so you constantly see this sort of cycling, and it depends on who's in power, who's being criticized, who's being censored, and then people often do want retribution, for sure.
Constitutionally, just playing right off of that, Attorney General Pam Bondi came out and talked about prosecuting people for their hate speech. And, the real test of free speech is whether or not you can tolerate the things you perceive to be hate speech to some degree and things that are unpleasant. But is there a limit to that? Was Pam wrong? And are there limits to what can be said in the public square when it comes to government intervention of the First Amendment?
She was completely wrong. I mean, wrong in a way that people in her position aren't normally wrong. The category of hate speech is not a constitutional category in this country. In some countries, it is, and you can make arguments that it perhaps should be.
In Britain, it's a huge problem right now.
Absolutely, but it is not a constitutional category. There are things that are hateful that are said that could arguably fall into other much smaller, narrower exceptions to the First Amendment, things like incitement and fighting words and things like that, and true threats. But those are really narrowly defined categories. We police them pretty well. We allow harsh, sometimes vicious, deeply critical speech that we very much disagree with, and we don't criminally prosecute for it, and we don't even enforce civil penalties for it. So, you know, doctrines are complicated. I'm not saying that you can say I'm not saying that no one's ever prosecuted for anything they ever say anywhere, but simply calling something hate speech and saying it's outside the First Amendment is like, you know, something that gets you an F in a common law class.
Good to know. James, I want to circle something back to something that was mentioned just briefly, explicated a little bit, public broadcasting and the loss of funding with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The right didn't like a lot of the messaging coming out of public media. It was taxpayer funded, so they said, no mas, no more. Is that legal? Is that the government stepping in to control free speech and content? Even if they were right, and they did, and if you did a big content analysis, you found out, no, it is a left-leaning organ. How do you view that pressure, and how do you view Congress's action when it comes to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting?
I mean, I don't think it would be illegal, would it? I mean, Congress can fund how it wants to fund. What do you think about that?
Well, certainly Congress in the long term can make funding decisions to promote particular visions and particular values. When there are pre-existing commitments and funding streams and things like that that exist, and long-term commitments and budgets and contracts and things like that that are then broken because of concern about particular viewpoints, particular things that are said, that can potentially raise issues. The area that I'm not clear about here, and I would need a primer, maybe you can give it to me, maybe you can't, is I don't actually know the status of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting as an entity, how private it is, how government it is.
It's
and all of that.
Yeah. Pretty much all government, and 2 years forward funded, and as you suggest, that was rolled back, and that's where I think the interesting legal question comes into play.
I agree. I mean, and maybe because it is so entwined with the government, it's not even the most interesting case. There are lots of interesting cases right now about university funding, funding of scientists, funding of programs, where there are contractual commitments, statutory commitments, grants that are years out that are being rolled back. And I do think that those present unique and in some cases new constitutional issues. I think that there definitely is room for constitutional challenges there. Of course, the upside of winning those challenges isn't as high as it is in other contexts, because those 2 years will run out, those funding cycles will run out, and then government does have a lot of authority to make decisions as to what they want to fund.
Yeah, yeah. Talk a little bit about the Supreme Court and case law, and you both, I think, are involved in this. In kind of the modern era, privacy was a lever. That concept was a lever by which a lot of decisions were made. Now it feels to me like we're going to see a lot of court action possibly around free speech and First Amendment issues when it comes to flag burning or hate speech or funding corporation for broadcasting, whatever it may be. Is my perception here that this may be fertile new grounds? This may be a new lever for Supreme Court action, right or wrong? Set me straight. If I came to class with this theory, what would you hit me with?
Well, I think what I'd hit you with is the 700 pages of the casebook that already exist on the First Amendment. There's been lots of First Amendment litigation. You're absolutely right that there was a lot of privacy litigation under due process. There was a lot of equality litigation under the Equal Protection Clause,
yeah.
And that's being rolled back. It's not so much that freedom of speech litigation is going to jump up and fill that void, but it's an area that has always also been the subject of a lot of litigation that is... has not yet been rolled back.
Yeah.
The politics of freedom of speech at the Supreme Court have always been complicated. If you just lay out all of the cases that are decided without content, without who should be right on each, and just measure who voted for speech and who voted against speech, it hasn't historically been a left-right break. It's been much more complicated than that. So it's an area where some of the justices on the right might have pre-commitments that make them in play. It's an area in which some of the things that, like Pam Biondi is saying, are so far beyond the accepted position, where you have decisions, arguments with things like flag burning that are already decided. So it's an area where you could imagine the court pushing back against the Trump administration, despite its conservative majority.
And the case that got me to posit this is that the move that is afoot to make illegal conversion therapy in the states, and the pushback from states that want to do conversion therapy isn't, maybe some of the areas of law that you might expect. It's free speech. That we have a right to counsel without government intervention, people considering transitioning or whatever it may be. And I just found that to be a very interesting, I don't know about expansion, but new way to approach it. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it does seem like the Supreme Court might be in a position, or they likely will overturn the case from Colorado about conversion therapy on free speech grounds. The other area of law that I think is really interesting, which isn't necessarily the court, but it's also Congress, is Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act from 1996. And, both the left and the right and different administrations have talked about revisiting that, which gives broad immunity to online platforms for content that, I mean, first of all, it allows them to moderate content that they may find objectionable, but it also gives them broad immunity. And I think in kind of the broader conversation about whether, how, in what ways, why social media platforms might be moderated or not, there is a legal aspect of this, and I think both sides have an appetite to look at Section 230.
How would you argue it? Yeah, I think it's great you brought that up, and I appreciate that. Do social media platforms, when you look at, in my humble opinion, the destruction that's been wreaked upon democracy and society, do they need to bear some responsibility for being publishers in the most classic sense and have their feet held to the fire and being held to standards that make them somewhat liable for what they hath wrought. What do you think of that as a legal theory?
Well, it's not my nature to defend big corporations, but one of the things I will say is I think, you know, the kind of heyday of anything goes is over. I think they are trying to do various aspects of moderation themselves, and I think that might be a positive thing. I think it's going to take a while to figure out what works. And just to give a contrary opinion on, you know, them destroying democracy, obviously social media platforms have been the site of a lot of anti-democratic sentiment and the expression of that. But one good aspect of free speech is it lets you learn who the idiots are, and it lets you learn where there is opposition, and it lets you learn some social problems that people may not otherwise, you know, express. It sort of allows you to say, actually, you know, a lot of Americans believe this, or a lot of Americans don't believe this.
Or does it allow radicalization in what we saw with the Young Republicans?
Well, it does allow. Yeah, I mean, it is something that would facilitate that for sure. So there are positive and negative aspects of it, and I think that's why it's not surprising to me that both left and right have thought about what they want to do with Section 230, because I think they both are worried about this.
Aren't you glad I'm not in your constitutional law class making problems, Andrew? Same question for you, because I think 230 is so important.
Yeah, I mean, I see the arguments in favor of more corporate responsibility here, but I think the dangers on the other side of making big changes and imposing a lot of liability are probably bigger. I mean, when you get into a situation where they're making content choices, they're feeling responsible, they're taking things down, I mean, we have some evidence from the recent climate of what comes down. And what comes down and what gets criticized and what gets punished and what gets called hate speech is calling Charlie Kirk an idiot, saying that he's not some sort of hero just because he was assassinated, right? I mean, those are the kinds of things that people want to see taken down from social media. And I think that
globalize the intifada too, though. So,
well, I mean, yes, there are things that are hurtful and that are arguably over the lines of discourse, but I have not seen a coherent attempt to explain, what kind of pro-Palestinian and anti-Israeli speech needs to come down in the name of anti-Semitism that doesn't have terrible line drawing problems and that doesn't ultimately
Here's a radical idea. Professional gatekeepers.
I mean,
people who spent careers and lifetimes doing that job, who have been disintermediated. Do we miss them? Do we need them back?
Gatekeeping what, though? Gatekeeping the content that people see, what people can say?
Yes, making solid editorial decisions about what's relevant and how discussions can be productive as opposed to spiraling down a rabbit hole. I'm just throwing that out.
The devil's in the details. But I think for the most part, social media platforms aren't equivalent to newspapers or television stations. They're equivalent to message boards and town halls and open mic nights more than that.
Yeah.
I would say the walls in a bathroom stall, too.
Well, and I think this gets to kind of a broader thing throughout history, which is that on this point, which is that a lot of the supposed biggest proponents of free speech have been in an elite class who essentially wanted it for elites to decide and for elites to control,
yep,
but not for the common person to be able to engage with. So even if you think about, the printing press and then the Bible being printed in German during the Reformation, and, you know, the Catholic Church being very, very worried that suddenly this Bible, that everyday people can read it. You know, the
yep.
Catholic Church wanted to have complete control over information. And that's in part what allowed the Reformation to spread, is that everyday people were becoming literate and actually able to read it for themselves. And so that sort of, who are the gatekeepers, how are they defined, is a very interesting question.
Brings its own set of problems, doesn't it? Because too much of either is the wrong answer, and it's hard to get it right. Our last minute here, Andrew, what are people not getting about this conversation that they need to? What have I missed that you think is important to tell folks?
I think it can't be an abstract conversation. It has to be contextualized politically. And I really do feel like there is a new existential threat to dissent and freedom of speech in this country. And I think we have to identify it and speak about it as different in kind to some of the threats that we've faced. We have a president and an administration that doesn't really believe in dissent, wants to stifle it, wants to send in the army when they see it.
Biden administration did a lot of censorship on social media platforms.
I am not suggesting that the Democrats and other organizations don't violate free speech norms in some places, but I really do think that we are in a situation right now where we have a president. I won't say one side of the political spectrum. We have a president who does not believe in dissent and dialogue. And
to the point of being an existential threat, as you...
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. James, I'm going to give you the last 30 seconds here.
I mean, what I tell my students is always to steel person the other side. Always make the other side's argument as strong as possible and argue that, and then steel person your own side and argue against that. And so one of the things I try to teach my students is to get around Milton's curse. Look at the other side of the argument that you absolutely detest and don't like, and appreciate that it should be allowed to be shared, and then disagree with it. Come up with the best argument against it rather than trying to censor it. Build it up, make it better for, you know, make the argument better than that person maybe is making for themselves, and then argue against that.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of exchange intellectually is good for people, because then they understand why then when people are you know, opposed to their ideas or something like that, they should still be allowed to express those ideas and then have a fruitful conversation that hopefully, you know, gets us closer to the truth.
From your lips to God's ears. So I think that's a great place to end it. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Spewing hatred is always wrong, but so is defining hatred in such a way as to preempt honest debate about policy and social issues. The bottom line is that once we stop talking with each other, the republic is doomed. And in recent years, we've taken a lot of steps down that road. So please ignore the rage farmers. They're using your anger to make money, and it's destroying the country. Rather, pay attention to the people whose entire lives have been dedicated to helping you understand the world. The people doing great journalism, conducting and explaining solid evidence-based research, or leading meaningful discussions that are born out of deep learning and experience. As for the rest of us, we can make sure we're having the kinds of conversations with people that lead to understanding, not division. And my last rant, just get off social media for anything much beyond sharing personal interests or reinforcing relationships with family and friends.